The tape is on. Our topic for tonight is the first Knesset. First Knesset. So, last week we began the course with a discussion of the political landscape in 1948 on the eve of statehood. And the basic idea was that a Jewish state would be formed that would be democratic in nature. This was obligatory by UN Resolution 181 that called for the partition. It called for the creation of democratic states. So there has to be an election. The will of the people have to be heard. So the provisional government will be of limited tenure. When will the election be held? There's a war going on. It's not easy to carry out an election in the middle of a war. So it was supposed to take place October 1st, 1948. That was unreasonable, impossible. It was postponed several times. Ultimately, the election would take place on January 25th, 1949. And the question is, what are the citizenry actually electing? Is this a parliament? What are they voting for? Well, it was a constituent assembly. And a constituent assembly is not the same thing as a parliament. A parliament has a fixed term and can pass laws of any sort. Whereas a constituent assembly means that a state is in formation and elected representatives are supposed to represent the will of the people in crafting a constitution that will then lay the ground rules for further elections and functioning of government. So this was a constituent assembly election for the purpose of drafting the ground rules, a constitution for the new Medinat Yisrael. Then the question is, well, how many seats will be in this constituent assembly? How many representatives are going to be elected? So there were four ideas put forth. One was 70, like the 70 elders of ancient Israel. Another was 71, like the 71 members of the Sanhedrin. Another was 120, like the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah of antiquity, of Second Temple times. And another was 170, basically the 70 plus another 100, because you need to have more representatives because 70 isn't enough. So they settled on 120, which is halfway between 70 and 170, and because of the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah factor, and also because of a desire to eventually name the parliament the Knesset. So the Knesset of modern times will recall the Knesset of old. Okay. Who gets to vote? Well, citizens of the country. Universal suffrage over the age of 18. And it might sound like a simple thing to figure out all the people who are in the country over the age of 18, but that's not so simple. Because first of all, there's a war going on, so you have people who have been conscripted into the military, and they're not home. Moreover, people have been moving about to escape the battlefront. I mean, some Jewish settlements had been evacuated because it was too near the scene and had been lost. Moreover, what about the Arabs? There used to be 600,000 Arabs in the borders of the State of Israel as defined by the UN mandate, by the UN resolution. Where are these people? Well, most of them left. Some of them stay behind. How will we decide who is a citizen among the Arab population and who is a refugee not to be considered? It's a very difficult and tricky question.
Was there a residency requirement?
So the residency requirement was very strictly enforced when it came to the Arabs, not when it came to the Jews. When it came to the Arabs, if you even left your home overnight and they knew you had gone at some point, even if you had gone to a place within the boundaries of the State of Israel, you were already regarded as a refugee and subject to elimination, basically. So it was an ugly time. I mean, not a pleasant thing for the Arabs. As for the Jews, as long as you were in country and you were Jewish, you could vote. There was no such thing as an illegal Jew. All the laws of immigration of the mandate period, which meant that some Jews were in the country illegally and theoretically subject to deportation, that's over and done with. If you're a Jew in the land of Israel, you're a citizen of the State of Israel. So there was a curfew imposed one night in November between 5 p.m. and midnight. And in those 7 hours, the census was taken in one night of the whole country. In this country, it takes a whole decade to do a census. In that country, in Eretz Yisrael, one night in 7 hours, they did a census.
Without a computer,
yeah. How accurate? Who knows? They had representatives from the government going around and counting people.
Census
showed up here. So
how many did they have?
There were about 700,000 citizens. Well,
that's without Arabs.
No, inclusive of a small population of Arabs. Okay.
These are over the age of 18.
Yeah, yeah. What type of election will this be? Will it be universal, a broad constituency encompassing the entire country, where party lists are formed and you vote for a party and everyone's voting in the same election? Or are there individual constituencies, like in the United States, for Congress or for the Senate, you know, based upon regional district? That was a major question. The easiest way to go about it, and the one consistent with the Asefat Nivcharim, the assembly during the mandate period, and for that matter the World Zionist Organization, was to have no regional districts, just one election for the entire country with party lists. It was the cleanest, simplest, and most effective way to get the election over and done with. And so despite the fact that Ben-Gurion and Mapai very much would like to have individual constituencies, that didn't happen, and it never happened. Even to this day it hasn't happened. And that'll be an issue tonight towards the end of the lecture, how the Mapai tried to push for electoral reform but failed. Okay. What are the political issues in play as the election comes close? In December of 48, in January of 49, what are the parties going to fight about? Well, the big issue is the progress of the war. From the Mapai point of view, the war is almost over. Effectively, by the first week of January, it is over. And they're going to say, well, we won. We won a significant amount of territory, more than was allotted to us in the UN resolution. Therefore, we should regard our stewardship of the state as a success on many fronts, but including territorially. That we have more than we could have ever imagined, so we did a good job, vote for us. However, the territorial maximalists would say that in fact the outcome was a big disgrace. Whether the Achdut HaAvoda section of the Mapam, which was most of the military leadership, or for that matter the Herut right-wingers, they would say that the agreement with Egypt to allow the Egyptian military to remain in Gaza and to not dislodge them from Gaza and from the Fallujah pocket in the Negev was an embarrassing defeat for the IDF. That's what they would argue. And that the possibility of conquering the holy places in East Jerusalem and on the West Bank had been squandered and could have been successfully prosecuted if only the effort was there, the willingness to do so was there. So that's a maximalist point of view. What is Ben-Gurion and Mapai's retort? So their retort is, you have two choices. You can either have a Jewish state, or you can have Eretz Yisrael Hashlema. In other words, Ben-Gurion and Mapai did not doubt that the military in late 48, early 49, could have continued fighting and conquered more territory. It's just that that territory comes with an Arab population that is not good for the existence of a Jewish state in Medinat Yisrael. It would compromise it demographically to the point of there not being a Jewish state. So that was Ben-Gurion's line, and it remains an important aspect of Israeli politics to this day, Ad Hayom Hazeh. However, it should be noted that even Ben-Gurion had flights of fancy during the war and leading up to the end of 1948, early 49. And I'll mention two things in particular. One is that at one point in the summer of 48, late summer, early fall, he did suggest an attack on Jerusalem, Hebron, Beit Lechem, and to conquer the southern half of what is today the West Bank. And as for the fate of the Arabs who lived there, he said they would flee, just as they fled from Jaffa and from Haifa and from Ramla and Lod and everywhere else in pre-67 Israel that was conquered. So he did have that idea in his head. It wasn't acted upon for whatever reason, and we're not going to go into the military details, but he thought about it. Another thing he thought about is, well, let's pause for a second. Who's the GOAT of the 1982 war? Ariel Sharon, no doubt about it. Ariel Sharon is responsible for extending a war that was supposed to go to the Litani River all the way to Beirut. With what goal in mind? More than that, more than just a security buffer. What did he want to accomplish on a macro level? Not Greater Israel. No, 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 no. He wanted to create what kind of a state in Lebanon? A Christian state by taking the phalangist leadership of the Jamal family, having them duke it out with the Palestinians, kick them out of the country, fight it out with the Shiites and defeat them, have a Christian Lebanon, make a peace treaty with Israel, and totally reorient the diplomatic situation in the Middle East, and possibly even bring Syria along with it. So Begin paid the price in that he retired. He retired to sort of a quiet existence for the last decade of his life and then died and 9 years later as a broken man, whereas Sharon had a resurgence 17 years later and becomes prime minister. But my point here is, that was a crazy idea, right? It didn't work out. It didn't make much sense. It was a grand idea that failed because it was a little too grand, and Jamal was assassinated. So,
was his brother assassinated?
Yeah, a lot of the family was assassinated. It's not easy to be a Jamal. Okay? But, I bring all this up because none other than David Ben-Gurion himself invented the idea in 1948. He said to Yigal Yadin, in the course of the War of Independence, you know what we could do? We could get some low-ranking officer in the Lebanese army, a Christian, and doesn't even have to be a general, it could be a captain. And we'll raise him up a little bit. We'll conquer a little territory in the south of Lebanon. We'll make a puppet regime there. He'll make peace with Israel, and then they'll bring along Syria too, and we'll have peace on the northern border.
Sounds good.
Sounds like a nice idea. It's a crazy idea. They didn't implement it. Baruch Hashem, they didn't try to implement it. It would have gone just as disastrously as it did in 82. But I bring it up just because Ben-Gurion is seen at war's end as the more reasonable character when compared to the Achdut Avodah and the Chayrut. But really, during the course of the war, he also had Meshuggah ideas. And he had ideas about the distant future of conquering parts of Jordan, too. All right. Well,
what's the verdict of history? Could they, in 48, really have taken over that extra land in Jerusalem?
Most likely it would have been a very difficult battle against the Arab Legion, but it could have been done, and the major question is what happens to the civilian population if it were to be done. And that question was so scary and intimidating that it was never done.
Britain would have intervened.
It could be. It's quite likely. Britain intervened when they invaded Egypt. So, and Israel didn't want to have a significant battle against a Western power. Okay.
Shot down six Spitfires.
Yeah. Azar Weizmann did it. So, the election is coming, and Ben-Gurion's approach is, we want peace, but not at any price. So we're going to go to armistice negotiations and hope for the best. And the election happens during the armistice negotiations. The Mapai expected to win big, because as I mentioned, they had successfully prosecuted the war, brought in the first few hundred thousand new immigrants from the DP camps and elsewhere. They had made sure that the economy didn't totally collapse, although it came very close. So they're running the state reasonably well. They think they deserve another mandate. And Ben-Gurion thought that they would win a majority of seats in the parliament. Now, that never happened. Not in 1949, not ever. But he thought, not knowing how Israeli politics would shape up in the decades to come, that in the first election, they would win an outright majority. Yeah, you had a question.
It's a stupid question, but Israel went to general election, uh-huh, right? And the Arabs were supposed to go to election, too. Did anybody ever bring that up?
You mean an Arab state?
Yeah.
No, because it was very clear that there wasn't going to be an Arab state. The Jordanians had every intention of annexing the West Bank, which they would formally in 1950, and the Egyptians who took over Gaza, the big question in the armistice negotiations was whether they'd have to leave Gaza or their military could stay. Ultimately, Israel capitulated and allowed the military to stay, and that meant there wasn't going to be any Palestinian Arab entity at all. Right. So, the Mapam also thought they would do very well. Why? Because, number one, they had been an amalgam of the Hashem Eretz Tzair and the Achdut Avodah, so two factions which were substantial factions in labor Zionist politics had come together, plus most of the officer corps of the IDF was from the Mapam. And since the officers had won the war, well, maybe the Olam, the people, will vote for the party that won the war, as opposed to the party of government of Ben-Gurion. The Chairut also thought they would do very well, and even had a pie-in-the-sky a dream of winning. They didn't come close to winning, and they wouldn't for 30 years. But why did the Chairut think that they had a chance of major electoral success? This is an important point tonight.
Post-World War II refugees who came to Israel.
Okay, so there were, among the post-World War II refugees, a substantial element that liked the idea of the Irgun and wanted to vote for the successive party of the Irgun. It's true. But more than that, Menachem Begin and his cohort firmly believed that they were the ones who ousted the British from Palestine and set the ball in motion for the possibility of a Jewish state. So they recognized that, yes, they didn't win the war, that they were a minor element within, you know, the actual Milchemet Ha'atzmaut, but all this came to pass only because the colonial power left. And why did they leave? Because we blew up the King David Hotel, and we forced them out. And so we are the heroes, therefore the public will vote for us. It didn't work out that way. They won 14 seats. Now, they were eventually excluded from the cabinet on policy grounds, major differences between the Mapai and the Chairut, but also because the Mapai wanted to continue to, let's use the word, delegitimize the legacy of the Irgun by delegitimizing the political party of Chairut. And to say, you were wrong back then, and you're wrong now. That we were right back in the Mandate era of behaving ourselves in a restrained fashion, in the way the Haganah operated, and not the way you did in the as Vildachayas and the Irgun. And we're right now in stewarding the ship of state, and you have crazy policies on foreign affairs and defense that would get Israel into a heap of trouble, so you have no business controlling the reins of government. Therefore, the people shouldn't vote for you, and they didn't vote for you. In the symbolic realm, it was a little petty. Who was buried in Israel in 1949? The people who died in Israel, 1949. So that's number one. But also Theodor Herzl. Good. Who could have been buried in Israel in 1949 and wasn't? Jabotinsky. So Jabotinsky's wish was to be transferred. His body was buried at Wellwood out on Long Island because he died up in upstate at Beitar Camp. And his wish was a Jewish government in Eretz Yisrael should move my body to a suitable place in the Holy Land. And it was requested by the Chairut representatives that Jabotinsky, his remains, be brought to Har Herzl. And Ben-Gurion refused. And he refused and he refused and he refused. And Jabotinsky's remains were not transferred until 1964 when Levi Eshkol becomes prime minister. In another respect where the Irgun was made to feel inferior, that their injured soldiers were not given pensions, as were the Haganah soldiers of the pre-state period. That was later rectified. But in all these respects, the Irgun and the successor party, the Chairut, was seen as not kosher, beyond the pale, and thus to be marginalized. Okay.
Did Jabotinsky fight for the state, and wasn't it illegal for Ben-Gurion to declare that his body could not be transferred?
Ben Gurion is the head of government and makes the rules. You know? To the victor go the spoils. Jabotinsky died in 1940.
Okay, so
yeah. No. Yeah.
You mentioned that he was supposed to be delegations to vote for a constitution.
Yes.
So what happened to that?
Oh, we're going to get to that tonight. Don't worry, we're going to get to it. It didn't work out so well. Yeah. So the answer to that question is yes with respect to Arab voting rights. And I'm going to get to that in about 4 minutes. Okay, so the General Zionists were the middle class party, and they thought they would do reasonably well because they had been a major party in the diaspora, but they were terribly disappointed at the polls. Ultimately, the centrist parties did not do very well, and the left side of the aisle did extremely well. Then we go to the religious. How many religious parties were there? I went through it last week. There were four religious parties. Aguda, Pole Aguda, Mizrahi, Pole Mizrahi. In 1949, they formed the United Religious Front. And they won 16 seats. So they did fairly well. Why did they create a joint front as opposed to going it alone, each party on its own? So there was a pro and there was a con. The pro is that surplus votes aren't lost. What am I referring to? What are surplus votes? In America, we don't have this because we don't have a parliamentary system. But surplus votes are, let's say there are 100,000 voters, and it takes 1,000 votes to win a seat in a parliament with 100 seats, and then you get 1,437 votes. So the 437 votes are wasted because you don't get to the threshold of the second seat. So if you have four religious parties and four types of surplus votes, you're going to waste a lot of religious voters. If you have one block of four parties in one joint list, you only have one element of the surplus vote. So it benefits the Shomer Shabbos crowd not to have wasted votes. That's one positive side of things. The other is, if you have all the religious parties joined together, it becomes difficult for the religious voter not to vote for that block. As opposed to, if the religious voter is sort of tossed up between, am I a Pole guy, am I a Mizrahi, am I an Agudist, I don't really know, let me just vote for Ben-Gurion or Mapai. Which happens a lot, by the way, in Israel even to this day. I mean, what happened to Bayit Yehudi in one of the recent elections? They lost a lot of seats at the last minute to Likud because people wanted to vote for whoever become prime minister. And they didn't want to sort of waste their vote on a sectoral party. So that is a reason to have a block as opposed to minor little factions. What's the downside to having a united religious front from the standpoint of the Mizrahi and from the standpoint of the Aguda? Let's do the Aguda first. The downside is you're compromising your ideological purity. After all, Yagud was supposed to be anti-Zionist, and yet you're running on a Knesset platform with an avowedly religious Zionist party. That's not something that they'd necessarily be comfortable with and weren't after the first go-around. It never happened again. It didn't happen in 51, and it certainly wouldn't happen today. What about from a Mizrahi point of view? Well, the downside is that religious Zionists believed that they were Jews like everybody else, Zionists like everybody else, in a modern Jewish state, and they care about policy issues across the board. They would like to be relevant in matters of defense and foreign affairs, in matters of the economy, in matters of education, not just in matters of enacting Shabbos laws and you can't sell chametz on Pesach. Whereas the Aguda only cares about purely religious issues and doesn't have a stand on economic matters or matters of foreign affairs and defense. So by joining a united religious bloc, they run the risk of becoming in a policy ghetto, of only being relevant in the Ministry of Religious Affairs or the Ministry of Welfare, and not all the other aspects of governance. So it was a pro and con situation. They decided to do it one time, and one time only. It was not reconstituted in the next election. Well, getting into the government is not just about having a significant bloc in parliament. After all, the Mapam was the number two party and they didn't join. And for that matter, neither did the Herut as the number four party. The religious did because the religious wanted to, and they didn't have that many demands. Remember, what do religious people care about? Religious things. What do secular people care about? Everything else. So it's actually not that difficult for labor and for the Mapai to come to a historic cooperation, Hishutafut historit, with the religious Zionists. I mean, they were always together in all the governments. The Aguda less so, but the Mizrahi, the Mafdal, would always be together with the Mapai and its successor parties. Okay, what about the Arabs? So, it's a real question. Would the Arabs have the franchise? And here's to your issue, would the UN get involved? Would the international community throw a fit? So there were those who said the Arabs shouldn't vote. This is a Jewish state. They shouldn't vote. That wasn't going to go over well with the international community. And Ben-Gurion knew that. The Mapai party knew it. So that was not going to be an option. The Arabs would have to have the franchise. But in light of the fact that there were a lot more Arabs in the country than all the Jews really would have wanted, in other words, even though there was a tremendous refugee situation, there were still 100,000 Arabs, 150,000 Arabs in the country. And that's a lot of Arabs. And that's a lot of Knesset seats if they vote at 100% ratio and for their own parties. So what do you do to limit the influence of the Arab population upon parliamentary politics going forward? So one option is, and this is a brilliant one, split the vote by creating like 10 different Arab lists and confuse the population so that they'll vote equally for all of them and none of them will cross the threshold and nobody will be elected. It's a scam, but it's one that theoretically they could have pulled off, and to an extent they really did, because the Arabs were under military government from 1949 through 1966, and it was not a simple thing to be an Arab citizen of Israel in those years. You really didn't have freedom of movement, and so you couldn't do electioneering and understand the political system as the Jews could. Another option is have Arab members in the Zionist parties and throw them a bone by having one of their representatives be down on your Knesset list in the election. In other words, you're on, you know, 34th on the list is some guy named Muhammad. Today, that's exactly what happens. Most of the major Zionist parties have some Druze or Arab Christian, even Arab Muslim, down towards the bottom of their Knesset list. And sometimes they even get a seat in the parliament. That wasn't really much of an option in 1949. There was only one Arab member of Knesset from a so-called Jewish party. The other option is to create Arab parties, and a limited number of them, but have them affiliated with a Zionist party, notably Mapai. And that's what ultimately happens. Only one truly Arab party was elected to the Knesset in 49, the Democratic List of Nazareth. It had two representatives. It was an affiliate, a satellite of the Mapai, totally beholden to Ben-Gurion, and would vote with the government in all matters. Bismanenu, in our day, the Arabs vote against the government every time, no matter what. It's de rigueur. The only exception was in 1992, the Rabin government, where they voted for the peace process, just because it meant Jews giving away land. But basically, the Arabs vote against the government all the time. But not then. The Arabs voted for the government. And this would continue throughout the 1950s, because these were Mapai satellite parties.
What was in it for them?
Jobs. The Mapai bureaucracy could boss people around, and when it came to just the food supply, the rationing regime, and labor exchanges, employment, you were dependent upon political party and patronage. So there was a real linkage between the Arab political class in parliament and Mapai. Okay. So now it's time to make the coalition. But before we can make the coalition, I have to give you the numbers. Who actually made it in? So, the numbers go like this. Mapai, 46 seats. Mapam, 19 seats. The Religious, 16 seats. The Herut, 14 seats. The General Zionist, 7. The Progressives, 5. The Sfardim, 4. The Democratic List of Nazareth, 2. The Fighters List, 1. That was a leftover from the Lehi, from the Lochamei Herut Yisrael, from the Stern Gang. Women Zionist Organization, 1. And the Yemenites, 1.
Communist
4. I left out Maki. Communist got 4. So, in the coalition, it would be inevitable that you'd have Mapai in the lead. After all, no party could form a government other than them. They have 46 out of 120. It would be impossible for anybody else to do it. So, it's going to be the case that Chaim Weizmann, upon being elected president of the state, after the parliament convenes in February of 49, that he'll turn to David Ben-Gurion and say, please form a government. And Ben-Gurion will be successful, but not in the way that he initially anticipated or desired. Ben-Gurion put out a call that said, all the constructive and productive forces of Zionism shall be invited to join this coalition, ranging from the Mapam on the left to the General Zionists on the right. Meaning that in theory, he could have had a coalition that included all the members of parliament except Maki, Herut, and maybe some of the minor factions. But that's almost everyone. What ended up happening is the Mapam refused to join. Why? Differences over foreign policy. And also a desire on the part of Mapam to preserve their independence when it came to promoting the true labor Zionism, the true Chalutz-style Zionism. And they thought that Mapai were a bunch of sellouts to the Western imperialists. Who else didn't join? The General Zionists didn't join because they couldn't get two ministries. They wanted two because they had an internal issue. There were two leaders. And if you only get one ministry, who's in and who's out? So it's always like a petty machlokes over who's going to get the spoils. That kept the General Zionists out. Yeah?
What influence did Jews outside of Israel have on the election?
Almost none.
The American government, anything?
None. So, the Sephardim were included. Why? The theory was, this theory remained an important element in Israeli political thinking for the next several decades, that if the Mapai is not good to the Sephardim, throw them a bone, the Sephardim will vote en masse For who? Menachem Begin and the Chirut. Okay, eventually they did. Not right away, but eventually, by the late 60s and 1970s, it's a major element of the Chirut constituency is the Sephardic population, especially the Moroccans. But in 1949, the Sephardic population was looked down upon by the elite Ashkenazim and was seen as something of a threat. So we can neutralize the threat by including the Sephardim in the government and throwing them one ministry. What ministry was that? So it was the Ministry of Minority Affairs. I mean, there's an American equivalent in in the HUD. It's like the functional equivalent. So, but Minority Affairs didn't mean Jewish minorities. It meant the Arabs. And Bechor Shalom Shitrit, who was the head of the Sephardic Party, was seen in his limited role in 1949 as a Minister of Minority Affairs as being too friendly to the Arabs. That he wasn't dispossessing them enough and wasn't pushing them around enough like the Mapai would have wanted. And so they took him out of that job. And they made him Minister of Police instead. Which also had a relationship with Minority Affairs and the Arabs, but it wasn't as direct. Now, all this is to say, keep the Sephardim in line and not in the realm of the Chirut. And also, it would not be nice if there was a cabinet of 12 white Ashkenazim and there wasn't one Sephardi. It would look unseemly.
What percentage of the population was
Sephardic? I don't know exactly, but it probably was about a fifth. It was growing substantially throughout 49 because you had massive immigration from North Africa, and then the Iraqi population started coming, and then the Yemenite population started coming. But even before the mass aliyah, there already was a very significant Sephardic population. I would imagine something in that ballpark. Okay, so Ben-Gurion has a theory about how to assemble a coalition. First of all, always have more than you need. Why? You don't want to be in a situation where one party bolting the coalition collapses the government and forces new elections. So always have extra parties. A major supermajority in the government as opposed to the opposition. No blackmail possibilities. Then, ideological balance. If you invite a party that is to your right, also invite a party that is to your left. Meaning if the Mapam is invited, then also invite the general Zionists. But sometimes it doesn't work out. Sometimes people say no, and other sides say yes. So another component is, never invite a more extreme party until you've already exhausted all possibility of including a less extreme party. In other words, don't go to the Chirut or even the general Zionists until you sign up the progressives and the Sephardim. And don't try to sign up the Aguda until you've signed up the Mizrahi. So, Seichel would dictate that this is true, but sometimes it doesn't work out. Okay. Keep the cabinet small and manageable. Don't have too many ministers. And the majority of the ministers have to be from your own party. Which leads to another point, and that is, have your own party's ministers, Sarenu, as they were known in Mapai, caucus ahead of the cabinet meeting and come to a consensus so that when you actually go to the cabinet meeting, it's a fait accompli because a majority is of your own party. Your party has achieved unanimous consensus even if it wasn't unanimous to start off with. And the other ministers' votes don't really matter. So therefore, although it's a coalition government, it's really one-party government. And really one-person's government because who's going to buck the word of David Ben-Gurion? And which leads to criticisms that this is a tyrannical regime and that it's not really democracy at work. There were all sorts of criticisms of the first government of Israel, from those to the far left and to the far right. Okay. Another point. Mapai should keep all the good juicy portfolios. Don't give the lesser parties things that really matter. Throw them a bone, a pittance, you know, give them the postal services. So I'll read to you who was minister of what, and you'll see what I'm talking about. The prime minister and defense minister was David Ben-Gurion. Last week someone questioned why is the prime minister necessarily the defense minister, and I said that was Ben-Gurion's shtick. Ever since 1946, he wanted the defense portfolio, that it would continue under Levi Eshkol, and would cease to be the operating method when Dayan was appointed defense minister in 1967. Agriculture and rationing was Dov Yosef. Now, I said rationing. That's an important point. Will lead to the fall of the government. Dov Yosef, and we'll talk about it more in 10 minutes, was known as Yosef HaMashbir. Right out of the Bible. Okay, Bernard Joseph, born in Montreal in 1899, becomes Dov Yosef when he moves to Palestine in 1926. He's a lawyer, is a real first world kind of person. He wore a suit and tie all the time. He looked out of place. He looked like he was part of the mandate and forgot to leave when the British left. But he was Yosef HaMashbir. He was Joseph the supplier, because if you needed it, he had it. And nobody else had it, except the black market. Then education, Zalman Shazar. What was Zalman Shazar's real name? Shner Zalman Rubashov. Shazar, Shner Zalman Rubashov. But he becomes third president of Israel after Yitzhak Ben Zvi in the 1960s. He's education minister. At a later time, it became standard practice to give the education ministry to what party? To the Mizrahi, to the Mavdal. But not then. Education is very important. And it's going to be a reason for the fall of the government in the first Knesset over education in the immigrant camps. So the Mapai has an agenda of creating labor Zionist Jews out of those coming from Chutz La'aretz. You need a Mapainik in the education ministry. Okay, foreign affairs, Moshe Sharet. Now, Moshe Sharet had been the head of the political department of the Jewish Agency since the 1930s. He was Ben-Gurion's sidekick, although him and Ben-Gurion really didn't get along, and Ben-Gurion didn't respect Moshe Sharet, and Sharet knew it. Their relationship was very rocky, and ultimately he was fired in 1956. But bear in mind the following. Although the Mapai held on to the foreign ministry was not important. Sharet was the first foreign minister. Who was the second foreign minister? Golda Meir. She held the job from 56 to 66. Who was the third foreign minister? Abba Eban, 66 to 74. None of them were ever important. And that might sound like a shocking statement, because I spent a whole lecture last year, or 2 years ago, on Abba Eban, and he's one of my heroes. But Lamaisa, he wasn't important as a foreign minister. He was much more important as an ambassador to the UN and the US. Ben-Gurion said it very simply. The foreign ministry is just the propaganda department of the defense ministry. That what matters is defense and security. And we'll have to lie to the Goyim, and we'll have a foreign minister who will lie to the Goyim. That's all it was. So Sharet wasn't really taken seriously, and when Golda was in charge, Ben-Gurion and Levi Eshkol operated behind her back, and then when Abba Eben was the foreign minister, Eshkol and Golda Meir operated behind his back with Simcha Dinitz. Okay, the foreign minister was always just like a showpiece, but never really doing much. All right. Then finance and trade and industry was Eliezer Kaplan. Then we get to the religious parties. Transport was David Remes, who died while in office during the first Knesset. The police ministry was Bukhar Shalom Shitrit, the Sephardi. Pinchas Rosen, of the progressives, was the justice minister. He was a lawyer, he had legal training, he was a law and order kind of guy, a first world person. His real name was Felix Rosenbluth. He becomes Pinchas Rosen when he makes Aliyah. He's a German Jew, German universities, German law school, justice ministry. This is going to be a first world country with real laws. Okay, so it can't be that some guy without a necktie from Russia, Poland, who's a Mapainik, is going to be the justice minister. That doesn't work. The religious parties have three ministries. Chaim Moshe Shapira, the head of the Mizrahi, is the health and immigration and internal affairs minister. Yitzhak Meir Levin of the Aguda is the welfare minister. And Yehuda Leib Maimon, or Yehuda Leib Fishman, he changes his name to Maimon, is the Minister of Religious Affairs and of War Victims. Because 1% of the population died. 6,000 people died. There was an important issue of burial and taking care of those who had passed. So this was the government. Limited. 7 Mapai members, 3 religious, a Sephardi, a progressive. Simple. Will it last? Is it workable? So, ultimately, we'll have its downfall, not on matters of security and defense and foreign affairs, although that is an issue. Its downfall will be over education and religion and the economy, the rationing and supply. So, let's see how much time we have left. Okay, we'll cover the whole thing. On the issue of foreign affairs, after the armistice agreements were signed, the border was fairly quiet. 1949 was actually a pretty good year when it came to matters of defense. Really, things wouldn't heat up until the early 50s with the Fedayeen. Not until about 53, 54. I mean, there was always some element of problem at the border, but it was fairly quiet. The biggest international issue was Jerusalem. Is Jerusalem part of the state of Israel? That's the major question. So in the partition plan, it clearly was not. It's a corpus separatum. It's an international city. And on December 5th, 1949, the UN took a vote advancing the cause of the internationalization of Jerusalem. So what is the state of Israel going to do about it? The capital of Israel is Tel Aviv. So Ben-Gurion has an idea. We'll stick it to the Shmum and move the capital to Jerusalem. And you know what? We don't even need a vote in the parliament to make that happen. Why? Because King David did it 3,000 years ago. So we're just going to act. So unilaterally, he says, we're doing it, whether you like it or not. Now, did the government, did the other members of the cabinet agree with him? The answer is not all of them. In fact, there was significant opposition. Moshe Sharet, ever the diplomat, said, oh, how could you go against the United Nations? To which David Ben-Gurion said, you're a loser. Well, of course we can go against the United Nations. And Sharet resigned. And you know what Ben-Gurion did to the resignation paper? He threw it in the garbage. You're not resigning. So Ben-Gurion bullied Sharet a lot, especially on this issue of Jerusalem. But other members of the government were equally opposed. Some thought it was a silly idea that Jerusalem is a little village on the border. It's not a safe area. It's not a big city. It doesn't have the infrastructure for running the country. Tel Aviv is a big city. It's the capital of Israel. So it was a good argument. And the weather was bad in Jerusalem, and some of the members of the government were of weak constitution. They preferred the Tel Aviv climate to the Jerusalem climate, especially in the winter. It was December, remember. Ultimately, what happens, there's no Knesset vote, there's just a fiat. We're going. But not everything went to Jerusalem. Two things remained behind in Tel Aviv. Defense remains there to this day in the Kiryat. It's not in Jerusalem because Jerusalem is too sensitive an area. It's too near the border. The other was foreign ministry. Sharet had a point that if we move the capital, you run the risk of alienating countries around the world that already have diplomatic relations with Israel. So therefore, the foreign ministry was only moved in 1953, lest it rock the boat too much and you lose the diplomatic relations on account of this decision. I mean, Ben-Gurion himself realized it was a risky proposition. He was afraid of the reaction of the Soviet Union, of the Vatican, and of the Arabs. But he knew, ultimately, that it would work out well. Because who was the greatest ally to Israel on the matter of Jerusalem? No, not the U.S. and not Russia.
The Vatican.
Wrong, no.
Britain?
No, getting closer though.
France.
Wrong.
Scotland. Ireland.
Jordan. Why Jordan? Because Jordan has the eastern half of the city. Internationalization is as bad for them as it is for the Jews. So they Ben-Gurion knows that Abdullah loves the Temple Mount, will not want to give it up. So just as he's not going to go to the Temple Mount, we're not going to give up Rehov Ben Yehuda. You know, everybody's going to have what they have, a divided city, but each side claiming assertively the portion that they have.
Yeah. The world have a nervous breakdown?
No.
No. I don't give a damn.
No, it was an issue that came and went. Came and went. Okay. All right. An important question is, what's happening?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Ah, yeah. So, someone had asked earlier, what happened with the Constitution? Whatever happened, what was this Parliament actually doing? So the answer is that 2 days into the session, on February 16th, 49, they passed the transition law. And the transition law said that this is not a constituent assembly anymore. This is the first Parliament. This is the Knesset. And some members of the Herut threw a fit and said this is a political push by Ben-Gurion. It's an illegitimate move. Why is it an illegitimate move? Because after all, we elected people to produce a constitution and only that, which would be followed by subsequent elections. Whereas now you're claiming this is a parliament, and yet there's no law on the books that says when this parliament comes to an end. It's open-ended. So that is the that means that there's a possibility that Ben-Gurion becomes like Abu Mazen. He's in his 13th year of a 4-year term, you know, or an ill-defined term. Herut had a very strong point there, but it was brushed aside. Don't worry about it. We'll figure this out as we go along. And ultimately they did. The second transition law said there's a 4-year term. But why was there no fixed term even before the first election? So the answer is that it was felt to be inappropriate for a provisional government that was unelected to set a limit, a time limit on an elected body, which would be the Constituent Assembly. It's unseemly for an unelected parliament, provisional council, to limit an elected body. Therefore, the elected body will ultimately figure out how long subsequent terms will be. Okay. The cabinet fell in October of 1950 over religious education in the immigrant camps, and also over Ben-Gurion's desire to shut down the rationing ministry and to appoint a businessman as the Minister of Trade and Industry. What happened in the immigrant camps? So, Israel in 1949 was like two countries. There was the regular Israel, and then there was the Shar Aliyah and the Ma'abarot. For those who had jobs and had housing, they probably had running water and electricity even by 1949. Most of the settled country did at that point. And life went on, as it did in the later years of the mandate. It was reasonably comfortable. But if you were a newcomer, you were shipped off to some immigrant depot, and then later to the transit camps, the Ma'abarot, and you didn't have running water, and you didn't have electricity, you didn't have adequate housing, you lived in a tent, it was horrible. And in those camps, there was a lot of political activity.
They were mostly
Tzrifim, they were not tents. Huts. Those who came early actually had real housing, because they lived in Arab housing. The Ma'abarot were not started until middle of 49, since the Arab housing sort of was exhausted sometime late in 48, January of 49. Then you had makeshift housing, and then you had the full-scale Ma'abarot.
When you say Arab housing, those who left.
Those who left, right. Who fled. And by the way, there'd be fist fights between Jews over who got to live in those houses, because the government would allocate it, but what proof did you have that some bureaucrat gave you this apartment? Nothing, other than what you could defend with your own two fists, you know. There's a book by Tom Segev, who's one of these new historians, is a big left winger, and I don't like him, but his book is a good book, 1949, The First Israelis. I suggest you read it. You could buy it on Amazon for cheap, like $2. 1949. It's a very good book. You'll walk away not so happy, but it's important to know. So, in the transit camps, tremendous political activity, because all the parties know these are voters. These are new citizens who haven't developed partisan attachments yet, but they could if you provide them with what they want, namely bread, employment, and education for their kids. But what kind of education are the kids going to get? So the Sephardim who came from North Africa and Middle Eastern countries, on the whole, were traditional Jews. Not entirely Orthodox necessarily, and sometimes illiterate, but with a favorable attitude towards tradition, and especially the Yemenites were very, very frum. So the religious parties thought they should corner the market on educating these children. But yet that wasn't the case, because the government tried to maintain the kind of percentages of the Yishuv-era education system. Now, there were four school systems. There was the General Zionist, there was the Labor Zionist, which was run by the Histadrut, and there was the Mizrahi, and there was the Aguda. The General Zionist being the largest, then the Labor, then Mizrahi, then Aguda, in that order. So they're fighting over who gets what kids. And there's accusations that the payers of the Yemenite kids were cut off, and that they're forced to eat treif and do things on Shabbos, and they're not allowed to daven, and that some kids are disappearing and being taken off to who knows where, and never reappearing. Okay, all sorts of criticisms. So the government had to do something about it. And the Frumkin Commission was established, which basically said that Nachum Levin, who was in charge of education in the camps, had overreached in trying to indoctrinate the kids in secular labor Zionism. That there was an element of truth to the religious party's criticisms of the government's handling of education in the camps. So, without going into too much great detail about this, so this was a major crisis and issue, the government falls in October of 1950. At that time, Ben-Gurion tries to establish a minority government. Because remember, he had not a very large government to begin with. He had 46 seats. The progressives were 5, that's 51. The religious were 16, that's 67. The Sephardim were 4, that's 71. And the Arabs are 2, 73. So 73 minus 16, if the religious walk away, is 57. Last I checked, 57 is less than 60. It's a minority government. So could that be possible? And the answer is, in theory, yes, if the opposition doesn't vote no confidence, but it wasn't going to work itself out. It was tried, it was attempted, it failed. So Chaim Weizmann now has a question on his hands. Is it necessary to call for new elections? Or can he tap someone else to form a government? So he calls up his good buddy Felix Rosenbluth, Pinchas Rosen, the justice minister, and says, you want to form a government? But the progressives only had 5 seats. How is a 5-seat faction going to form a government? Ridiculous. It isn't going to happen. So ultimately Ben-Gurion is able to make shalom with the religious, and the same government is reconstituted, the same exact parties, just with a shuffling of the ministries. What happens is that Zalman Shazar is out at education, Dov Yosef is out at rationing, which is abolished, David Remez goes to education, Pinchas Lavon goes to agriculture, and a businessman goes into the Ministry of Trade, Yaakov Geri. So, basically the same government with minor tinkering. This government doesn't last very long. The same problems emerge, and in February of 1951, there's a crisis over a failure of the government effort to register school children, and the cabinet resigns. Ben-Gurion resigns, and there's a caretaker regime until the next election on July 30th of 51. So, you would think then that the relationship between the religious parties and David Ben-Gurion was frayed and could not be repaired. After all, they're really fighting, they're battling over souls in the immigrant camp. And also there were other battles over Shabbos in Yerushalayim. The religious parties put forth legislation to basically ban malacha on Shabbos in Yerushalayim, which didn't go over well, never passed. There were issues of movie theaters being open on Saturday night, showing a double feature, and opening the box office an hour before Shabbos was over. There was a terrorist incident involving a bunch of people who were arrested, who threatened the secularists. The secularists respond. Religious issues are a problem in 50 and 51, and they're a political problem at that. So some of the religious politicians really didn't like Ben-Gurion. However, I want to read to you a comment that was made by Rabbi Maimon, Yehuda Leib Maimon, to his son-in-law, Yitzchak Raphael, who was a government employee, about Ben-Gurion. Listen carefully. If it had not been for Ben-Gurion, it's very doubtful if we would live to see the state. So his son-in-law, Yitzchak Raphael, said, but we believe that the state was given by God. Could God have chosen as his messenger a man who violates the Sabbath and does not keep the law? So Maimon grew thoughtful and finally said, quote, it's miraculous that Ben-Gurion is not an observant Jew, or people might mistakenly believe that he was the Messiah who has not yet come. So he's the Mashiach, practically, from Rabbi Maimon's point of view. Well, let's bear in mind that Rabbi Maimon, as the leader of the Mizrahi, has his historic cooperation with the Mapai, and that kind of verbiage was not coming out of the mouth of an Agudist. The Aguda would remain in the cabinet for the next cycle after the 51 election, but they would leave in 1952 over the issue of conscription of women into the army, which we'll talk about next week, basically not to return until the Likud comes to power many, many years later. But the religious Zionists, they had a soft spot in their heart for the Mapai, even though the worst elements of the Mapai were subverting religion all over the country and corrupting the youth. Okay. So, in the few minutes we have left, let's discuss the failure to produce electoral reform. And for that matter, the Constitution. Why did electoral reform fail? Who was in favor of it and who was opposed? So the minor parties obviously are against having individual constituencies because they're only a percentage of the electorate and everywhere they will lose. Unless you're like the religious party in Bnei Brak or in certain sectors of Yerushalayim, you'll win the vote. You'll win the majority because that's your territory. But if you're not a religious party, for that matter, an Arab party in Nazareth or the Galilee, if you're just a middle of the road party or even the Kheirut, where are you the majority? Nowhere. You're always a percentage of the population. Therefore, a broad national election with party lists and percentages of the population, that's what you favor. The Mapai favors winner-take-all because they're going to win in a lot of places. This doesn't happen, and ultimately a second major party doesn't emerge until some decades later. So whereas the Mapai wanted two major parties like in the United States or in England, with them winning most of the time, instead they were the only major party that had to cobble together coalitions until such time as a second major party could emerge when Gachal becomes the Likud and eventually is significant enough. Okay, so this, it failed because only Mapai wanted it. Even the Mapam didn't want it. What about the Constitution? So who wanted a constitution and who very much did not want a constitution? So the parties that are afraid of tyrannical rule by the majority very much want a constitution to protect their rights. The Mapam wants a constitution. Why? Because they think Ben-Gurion is a tyrant. Chairut wants a constitution. Why? Because they think Ben-Gurion is a tyrant. Yeah. Okay, and they're not so far off. What were the most disturbing aspects of British mandate legal policy? So the white paper, yes, on immigration, but forgetting the white paper, internally, what was the most difficult aspect of their rule? The emergency laws. What's an emergency law? You suspend habeas corpus, you suspend this, you suspend that, you put somebody in jail forever and they'll never know why. In 1948, under the provisional government, and even into 1949 under the first government, there were emergency laws in the state of Israel as a holdover from the British mandate. Who were they used against? The Arabs, of course. But what does a guy like Menachem Begin say? First they came for the Arabs, and then they'll come for me. And they'll use the emergency laws against my political allies, and Ben-Gurion will rule forever, and there'll be no democracy. So we need a constitution to prevent that sort of thing from happening. All right? Who's against a constitution? So the Mapai and the religious parties, but for different reasons. The Mapai is against the Constitution, not because ideologically that's the case. It's just because it's too difficult to produce one. And as the governing party, you don't need difficulties. You need to stay in power. You need to find compromises and convenient ways out of difficult, you know, difficult political spots. So, better to have something other than a rigid Constitution. The religious parties don't want one, because all the matters of religion and state, which were negotiated between 1947 and 1949, basically in favor of the religious at the expense of the secular, could be undermined by a constitution that would have a strict separation of church and state, or even if it wasn't a strict separation, was insufficiently considerate of religious demands. So why run the risk of losing the gains you've already gotten that are in hand on a constitution which is likely to protect freedom of choice, and the religious are against freedom of choice, at least vis-a-vis the secular. So, also, what is the constitution of Israel, of Am Yisrael, not Medinat Yisrael, Am Yisrael? The Torah, bingo, the Torah is our constitution. And so to have some man-made document in the year Tavshin Chet or Tavshin Tet, produced by the successors of Theodore Herzl without yarmulkes on their heads, that's a shanda. The Constitution is the Torah and the Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, so if you don't have a Constitution because the government is Mapai and the religious parties and both of them are against it, what do you end up left with? So the Progressive Party, okay, and this proposal was put forth by Yitzhar Harari, a lawyer who was an MK from the Progressives. He put forth the idea that we're not going to have a constitution. We're going to have a constitutional committee within the Knesset that will produce basic laws. And the basic laws, which will be passed by a supermajority and can only be undone by a supermajority, will be the de facto constitution. What will these the basic laws largely address? Governance and the institutions of state. And later on, like matters of civil liberties and personal liberties and protecting the minorities and the disabled and the human dignity. So over the years, there have been a number of such basic laws. There were more passed in the early years of the state than there have been recently, just because all the critical issues of governance were taken care of. But this concept of the basic law solved a major problem. It meant that the ruling party did not have to worry about crafting a constitution that could pass muster with the majority of the cabinet, the majority of the parliament, because such a thing seemed beyond reach. It was out of the grasp, even of the greatest of parliamentarians. They couldn't do it. So this is a halfway measure. Okay, we'll stop here. Next, yeah. Who said you didn't have to have freedom of speech? This is not America. It's a big deal here, but not necessarily there. Okay.